AppMedic Podcast, your bi-weekly dose of education and inspiration in the healthcare field.
Hey everyone, I'm Simmer, a student at Harvard University.
And I'm Daniela, a student at Oxford University.
And this is
the AppMedic Podcast. Enjoy!
In this podcast, we spoke to Dr. Jaden Bias, Program Director of the Internal Medicine Residency at Massachusetts General Hospital. We discussed the story behind how he became program director, what values he thinks makes an effective leader, and what it means to be a physician scientist. Today's show is perfect for anyone excited about medical education or just intrigued about how research and clinical medicine interface. So without further ado, let's have a listen. But before we get into the episode, I want to tell you briefly about our sponsor, Amboss. Created by a team of dedicated physicians from around the world, Amboss is an interactive library of over 20,000 medical topics, interlinked with a question bank holding more than 5,500 clinical case-based questions. With all the necessary resources in one place, Amboss instantly delivers up-to-date medical knowledge to students, physicians, and faculty globally. Amboss has powerful learning and clinical tools combined into one platform, making studying a breeze and life on the wards easier. With the Amboss library and question bank side by side, students can look up terms instantly when solving questions. Students and physicians around the world use Amboss material to excel in their exams and on the wards. So sign up in minutes at amboss.com. You can try Amboss risk-free with a trial today. Now, onto the episode. Hi, Dr. Bias. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with us. We normally start the podcast by asking the question, why did you decide to go into medicine?
Well, it was a wonderful opportunity, I think, for me to be in medicine as I now reflect on a career that has spanned over 25 years as an independent practitioner. Reflecting on the reasons I chose to come into medicine largely were from some early influences. I suspect I'm not alone by saying that a lot of early influences, dictated why I ended up choosing to go into medicine. I had a number of people in my distant family who were physicians. Most of them were in India. And I grew up with parents who had high expectations of my being able to have an impact in the world. And I saw the opportunity to both combine two passions, one in science and one in helping people, as a natural way to use medicine to be able to achieve both of those goals. And I couldn't be more happy with the choice that I made so many years ago.
Certainly. And throughout your career, you've combined many different things. For one, in your medical training, you completed your MD and PhD at Baylor College of Medicine. For students like myself, pursuing a PhD can be daunting because it certainly adds several years to an already long medical training process. So I wanted to ask you if you could tell us a little bit more about your decision behind pursuing that PhD.
Absolutely. So I think it goes back to those early experiences that I had. So when I was exploring just out after high school and during my college years, whether I wanted to do medicine and how I was going to do that, I really ended up with a couple different experiences. The first one I had, or the first two experiences I had, were largely clinical. The first experience I actually had was one where I just finished, graduated from high school. I'd asked a friend if they had any openings at the hospital. There was an opening for to serve as essentially the janitor for the operating room. And they said, well, you don't have many skills. You're a high school graduate, so maybe you could serve as the janitor in the operating room. I jumped at the chance. It was an opportunity for me to actually be in the operating room and be able to see what was going on and have really an intimate view of that. That reinforced a lot of what I wanted to do. I had opportunities to talk with physicians and nurses and many other members of the health staff, and reinforced my love for that profession. My next part really came into working over at Bentop Hospital, which is a public hospital in Houston, Texas, where I had the pleasure of working with a trauma surgeon and learning and watching how his team took care of all sorts of patients as they came through. And so that those two experiences really solidified my desire to end up going into clinical medicine. The next two opportunities really were much more in the area of research. I was very fortunate, again, to find an early mentor who was a virologist over at Baylor College of Medicine, who allowed me to kind of spend some time in his lab learning how to ask scientific questions and helping him try to answer some important questions about the genesis of cancer and certain genes that promote cancer in both mice and humans. That led me to do a deeper exploration by spending a summer over at the National Institutes of Health, where I learned a lot about the immune system in the Laboratory of Immunogenetics at the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease. And after that experience, I had two loves. One was in clinical medicine and the other one was in science. And so I really sought to find a training program that would allow me to express my creativity and my impact through both of those. And that's when I came across the medical scientist training program, or the MD-PhD program, which those graduates oftentimes as physician scientists both not only take care of patients, but also try to advance knowledge through basic investigation. And seeing role models in that area really energized me and said, I pointed at those individuals and I said, those are the types of people that I want to be when I grow up.
You know, you're continuing that work, of course, now as a physician scientist. At Massachusetts General Hospital, I know that you lead an active basic science laboratory. At a 30,000 foot view, could you tell for the listeners that don't know, already know, what your lab investigates?
Sure. My lab is interested in understanding some of the initial immune responses that happen to patients when they encounter a fungal pathogen. And there's many fungal pathogens out there that we know cause human disease. Recently in the news, many may be aware of that there was an outbreak of mucormycosis in India that was associated with the COVID pandemic. And that is a mold that can cause terrible infection in the upper respiratory tract as well as in the lung. In those patients that were affected in India, many of those patients died as a result of that infection. And even in the United States, that oftentimes leads to significant morbidity and mortality. We know that as we continue to make medical advances in medicine, we are now developing a cadre of patients who I will call immunologically fragile. They're alive, but they're immunologically fragile. And they're susceptible to a wider array of pathogens than people with normal immune systems. And some of those pathogens include fungal pathogens, and how our body with a normal immune system is able to manage those infections, and with an abnormal immune system, how they're able to succumb to those infections. Those rules on how the body governs the host response to those pathogens is the focus of my laboratory.
Really, really fascinating. It seems like you do a lot of basic science research, and I want to ask about that because it feels that increasingly students are shying away from the basic sciences, and it's hard to pinpoint why exactly that is. But perhaps that's because of its difficulty. Perhaps it's because it's perceived as being too far removed from clinical practice, or it's quote unquote high failure rate. So I wanted to ask you how you conceptualize the gap between bench to bedside and why you think basic science research is still worth pursuing among students.
I would say that my journey towards combining basic science in clinical medicine largely happened when I was taking care of patients as a medical resident here at the Massachusetts General Hospital. When I was a resident, I was involved in caring for a patient in the on the oncology floor. This was a gentleman who ended up undergoing a bone marrow transplantation. And while patients have a bone marrow transplantation, there's a period of vulnerability that they have as they're new bone marrow is engrafting in their body. So they're left with essentially no immune system, and the body is trying to develop the new immune system out of the new bone marrow cells that they received during the transplantation. And I was taking care of a patient who ultimately developed invasive aspergillosis. He was a lawyer by training who was, I think, skilled at asking good questions. And when I would see him, and as we were working up his fever and ultimately making the diagnosis of an invasive fungal infection, he often asked me a lot of questions. And the first question he asked me was, why me? He said, I'm on a floor where there's many other patients who are having bone marrow transplants. And as far as I can tell, I'm the only one who has likely invasive aspergillosis. So why me? And that seemingly simple question left me with essentially no answers. As a trainee, I sought more advice from my senior residents, my fellows, my attendings, and nobody could really provide me an adequate answer to that question. And I will say that question continues to stay in the back of my mind as I continue to see patients as we move forward. So many patients who receive a bone marrow transplant will never have to deal with the scourges of an invasive fungal infection, yet approximately 10% of our bone marrow transplant to patients who receive an allogenic bone marrow transplant will have this type of infection. Why 10%? Why is it that we have only a subset of these highly immunocompromised patients having this infection? And so the way to answer that question was really to go back and ask some simple and fundamental questions. How does the normal body respond to these infections? And what is it about these particular patients they're lacking that allows them to be susceptible? And then finally ask, what is it about the subset of patients who end up getting the infection? How are they different than the patients who are equally susceptible but don't end up getting that infection? We know that this Aspergillus, the model that I'm talking about, is a ubiquitous organism. So exposure to this organism isn't the key answer here. And so the only way to answer that question is really to use basic science and use discovery science to be able to ask specific questions about what's going on at the cellular level and at the molecular level. And while we start to answer some of those specific questions, I always remind people who are working in my lab, what is the larger question we're trying to answer? The larger question we're trying to answer is the same question that this patient posed to us. Why him? And as we think about why answering that question, we have to ask a series of mechanistic questions, and answering those mechanistic questions starts to allow us to approach answering those questions. So for me, basic science is still filled with the opportunity to discover new science that will have the opportunity to fulfill our promise to patients tomorrow for better care as we move forward. As someone who spends time training medical residents, I have two major responsibilities. One of them is to teach them what we know. And the second part is also to teach them what we don't know. What is the limits of our knowledge today? Why is it that we can't answer some of those questions? And empower the next generation of physicians to be able to start to address some of those questions so that we can actually improve life for all of the patients that we take care of in the future. There's many diseases that we have that are on the verge of being able to be cured, type 1 diabetes, certain forms of cancer, many types of infections. Just watching COVID-19 go from a disease we didn't even know what it was to now having multiple diagnostics and therapeutics in approximately 2 years' time gives me great hope that when collectively the scientific community and the medical community put their heads together, all things are achievable.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. I think the dual function of being both a clinician and basic science researcher, I think you need ideally both. It gives you a sense of the questions to ask and what questions need answered in the clinic, and then the mechanistic tools and opportunity to investigate those in the lab. You know, you of course wear many hats, and you're also the program director of the Internal Medicine Residency Program at Massachusetts General Hospital. You supervise around, I think, 168 interns and residents, which is an incredible number. I'd love to discuss your career trajectory a little bit more, because I think our listeners will find your story fascinating. So, starting off, you just graduated from Baylor with your MD, PhD. How did you work your way up to program director?
It's an interesting story, and one that as I was going through my MD, PhD, wasn't something that I aspired to. As I was going through, I saw myself essentially being a physician scientist. Many of my role models at that time spent 80% of their time doing research and about 20% of their time doing clinical medicine. And so for me, that's what my goal was. As I graduated from Baylor College of Medicine in Houston and then moved up to Boston to continue my internship and residency and eventually my infectious disease training, I saw myself eventually landing into that 80-20 role that I aspired to. If you were to have whispered in my ear as a senior resident that, you know, you would be the next program director at the MGH Department of Medicine, I would have said, oh, you've confused me for somebody else, because that was never on my radar screen. So I did what most of my most MD PhDs did, finished up after fellowship training, did a period of extended postdoctoral fellowship, first at Harvard Medical School, and then I moved over with my mentor over to the Whitehead Institute. And then was very fortunate to be recruited back to the hospital to set up my lab. And we started answering many of the questions that were important in the area of invasive fungal infections. And good observations and good people around me helped me to propel to have good papers, which led to grants. And we were off and running. My lab had essentially multiple NIH grants, and we had a wonderful group of people who were dedicated to the vision that I had of answering some of these fundamental questions in the interface between infectious disease and human immunology. And so at a time, I thought I was heading in the direction of just continuing to do that work as I wanted to. And along came the new chief of medicine at MGH, Dr. Katrina Armstrong, who was someone who really had a vision of invigorating science back into the medical training programs, and saw a very different vision than the way graduate medical education had started to move, which was largely focused on focusing just on the clinical part, but not necessarily on the science part. And for anybody who knows Dr. Armstrong, who now is the Dean of Columbia, she can be a very persuasive individual. And so after a series of conversations, she convinced me that being able to have an impact by training the next generation of physicians would be very impactful for me. And she was absolutely right. What I told her at the time was that I was not willing to give up my lab, that being a program director, which required a fair amount of work, had to dovetail with all of the things that I was also doing in the lab. And so through a fairly creative set of resources, I was able to accomplish that. And for the last 8 years, I've served as the residency program director. And I think that one byproduct of that is that physician scientists who train in my program can recognize that they're working with residency leadership that really understands what it means to be a physician scientist. And I use that term broadly. I just don't think that all MD PhDs or MD PhDs alone are physician scientists. We bring in a number of folks who are very interested in advancing human health through a variety of different mechanisms. So I consider nearly all of my residents physician scientists of some sort. Many of them will do clinical research. Many of them will focus on health policy. Many of them will understand how we can deliver care in the global setting in a more effective and culturally appropriate way. And so those individuals I see as leaders of American medicine in the next generation. And to be able to not only continue to contribute in my scientific area, as well as being participating in the training, I think leaves my residents with a role model of how one can not only continue to provide and contribute to the academic mission of the hospital, but also make sure that they see that patients that we take care of always come first.
Before we get back to the episode, a brief word from our sponsors.
AMBOSS is a medical knowledge platform built on three fundamental elements. At the core, a comprehensive medical library helps students learn the facts and the nuances of medicine. Also central is the QBank. By using these tools, students unlock the third element, personalized analytics, which helps students make smart studying decisions. Three essential tools of learning, all in one place. It's no surprise AMBOSS has become one of the most popular resources for students and schools worldwide. Ready to take a closer look? Sign up for a free trial today at amboss.com.
Now, back to the episode. No, that's really interesting. And I wanted to ask you a little bit more about your model of leadership, because as you mentioned, you've been program director for 8 years now, headed your lab for even more than that. What do you think makes an effective leader? And how about an ineffective one? What kind of values and qualities?
I think I've learned a lot on my job in terms of leadership. And I would say that the things that I think ring true are having a core set of beliefs and using those core sets of beliefs to be able to guide some of the complex decisions that we make. There's in training medical residents, there's always a certain number of choices that need to be made. There's only a finite amount of time. There's a finite number of spots that we have, and there's always a finite number of resources that we can provide in terms of that training. And so my team that I developed largely helps me think about some of those choices. And many of those choices are relatively straightforward, but many of them can be quite complex. And when you have a core set of beliefs, when you understand what your mission is, whether it be a residency program, a department, or an institution, it really does allow you to start to use that mission and that vision to answer some of those complex questions. I'll give you an example. One of the most challenging times to be a leader in a residency program or in an institution, a healthcare institution, was really at the start of the COVID pandemic. There were many questions and very few answers. It was going to be clear that my residents were going to play a pivotal role in managing the care of patients that were admitted to the hospital with COVID-associated complications. We knew very little about the disease and really lacked a fundamental understanding of the science, as well as had very few tools in our toolkit to be able to bring to bear for these particular patients. We kept two things in mind as we moved forward making complicated decisions. What was in the best interest of the community that we were serving, and specifically, I mean, patients that we were serving, and how do we best modify the workforce, modify the way we actually deliver care to ensure that we're matching the needs of those patients? And number two is, how do we try to preserve education, and how do we try to preserve wellness for those individuals who are working in these extraordinary environments to ensure that we are valuing those individuals who are contributing so much during the COVID pandemic? And so often I said that these are the two stakeholders that we will hold closest to all of the complex decisions that we will move forward. What's right for the patients and what's right for our residents are going to be, and we will work very hard to come up with solutions to ensure that both of these remain at the very forefront of what we do.
Wonderful. No, thanks for sharing that. And you know, last time we spoke was about 2 years ago, almost exactly 2 years ago in November 2020. So not necessarily at the start of the pandemic, but a little bit after. And when we spoke, you told me about the idea of the infinite game. And I've really treasured that idea. I've shared it with many other people, many of my friends and colleagues. For our listeners, I was wondering if you could explain the idea of the finite versus the infinite game and how you've conceptualized that across your own career.
Sure. I give a talk to our incoming interns at the beginning of orientation where I introduce this concept of finite and infinite games, a concept that I didn't create, but I borrow liberally from Simon Sinek and others who have really advanced this particular topic. And the idea is that for so much of what we do, there's the things can be activities that we are engaged in. They can be defined as either finite or infinite games. I'll give you an example. A finite game could be something like a baseball game, where there's two opposing teams, and then their goal in that game is to essentially win. One team will want to win over the other team. And everything is legal. Everything is legal to do, unless it's specifically stated that it's illegal to do. And the goal in that particular situation is to win. And I use that finite game as an opportunity to kind of think about how many students and trainees kind of work their way through kind of the path that is known as pre-med and medical school and even on to be a medical training. In high school, you're trying to achieve the best GPA maximize the number of AP courses that you take with the hopes that you will end up in the college of or the university of your choice, essentially a finite game. When you get to college, you know that your goal, if should you want to go into medical school, is to end up getting the best GPA you can and the highest MCAT score you can. And you will make certain choices that will allow you to try to maximize those two things, because as you know, as you try to get into medical school, you're going to be focused on those things. You're essentially playing that finite game. You're trying to win in that area. Even in medical school, there's oftentimes a lot of pressures in terms of performing, because if you want to end up in the residency of your choice, there's a lot of things that need to be done so that you can be enter into a competitive residency. Again, yet another finite game. When residents join me and they start to work and start to transform from a medical student to developing their skills to be an independent practitioner, I would submit to you that they need to move from that finite game to what is an infinite game. An infinite game is different than a finite game. An infinite game is where there are players. There not may or may not necessarily be two teams. And the goal isn't to win, but the goal is rather to have to continue the game for the love of the game. You want to make sure that you're continuing that, because there's a collective joy in playing the game. I'll give you an example. When I was growing up in my neighborhood, the neighborhood kids would get together and oftentimes play a version of kickball. And we would all come together and we'd play kickball. And we loved playing. We rarely kept score. We're not even sure who was on which team or the other. But the goal wasn't necessarily which team won and which team lost, but just to continue to play. What we feared the most was when one of our mothers would call us saying it was time to go in to have dinner. And then that would end up disrupting the game. But all we wanted to do was keep playing and playing that game. That's an infinite game. You're playing for the love of that game. And I would submit medicine, capital M, is an infinite game. And when you have gotten through the early part of your medical training, only playing a finite game, and you apply the skill sets that you have honed and honed very well as a finite game player to the infinite game of medicine, where our job is to journey with our patients through where they're going, to explore and expand the universe of knowledge that we have for the benefit of the patients that we serve. That is an infinite game. And we're all working together to try to continue to promote that part. And it's difficult if you don't conceptualize that there has to be that switch, because if you continue through medicine using that finite game model, oftentimes I see older physicians burning out, having a loss of sense of purpose. Many times you hear about, you know, older physicians telling their children, don't go into medicine, it's totally changed. Well, it all depends on your perspective of that. I have my older son is interested in medicine, and I think in large belief that he sees that I'm happy in my career in medicine and wants to have those same levels of joy in terms of the intact medicine. But I do it because I see that my competition isn't the person to the left or to the right. My competition is diabetes, heart disease, cancer, infectious disease. Those are the real enemies to a healthy population. Those are the things we can collectively come together around and try to work on and do it. And so I play the infinite game when it comes to medicine. And from my point of view, that's the way, as you start to make that transition, that's the way you will derive joy in the practice of medicine.
Mm-hmm. I think it really is that when you're going through medicine and life in general, right? It's not necessarily about competing. It's about being complete yourself. And I think that really is the idea of the infinite game. Well, I think that really wraps up the episode. But before we go, I wanted to ask you for your three pieces of advice for students who are interested in pursuing a career as an excellent clinician, educator, and researcher. The triple threat.
I'm happy to share. I will say that my three pieces of advice, number one is to follow your passion. You will have early experiences that will have an opportunity to share, to give you the opportunity to see, is this an area that you're really passionate about, or is this an area that you really appreciated the experience, but you want to move on to something else? If you love what you do, it's rarely work. That those are wise words from my mother, who taught me that to love your work means that you're not working at all. And so I have, by example, followed my passion into the areas that I do. Anytime I make a major choice in my career, I've always asked myself, is this my passion? And do I really want to do this? And do I believe that I will have an impact? And will I have joy in doing that? So number one is follow your passion. Number two, I will say, is to seek the truth. So much of what we end up doing in medicine is actually trying to identify the right clues in clinical medicine, trying to understand what those symptoms are trying to tell us. We listen to the patient because they oftentimes are the source of truth. And in the lab, we're always pursuing what we believe is truth. We are trying to determine what are the observations we can make in an experimental setting that allows us to reveal biology that we've not been able to reveal before. And so my second one is to seek the truth. And the third one really is to maintain intellectual curiosity. I think one of the joys of what we do here, and as an infectious disease doctor, I can tell you that when I trained, nobody told me anything about Zika, Ebola, chikungunya, or coronavirus, right? Those are things that I didn't know when I was trained, but I had the opportunity to experience, to learn, to remain intellectually curious, to continue to ask questions, and to watch the ever-expanding medical knowledge and how that had an impact. Another wonderful example of intellectual curiosity is really just to look at a pediatrician who was in Michigan, who started to notice that a number of her patients were having elevated lead levels, but didn't understand why. And didn't just chalk it up and say, well, there's a lot, I just have an unusual assortment of patients. But really ask the question, why? What was going on in that particular situation? It was through those observations and investigations that led to the greatest water crisis in Flint, Michigan, that we've seen in the United States, and led to structural changes in terms of how we think about water safety throughout the world. It's really through people like that who remain intellectually curious that will allow us to be able to kind of make the types of positive changes that we all want. So my third one would be to remain intellectually curious.
Wonderful. What a note to end on. Thank you so much, Dr. Bias. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Make sure to subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. You can also head to the description of this podcast to follow us on all social media so that you don't miss out on any of our content.